U.S. moderation of the radical sexual activists of the standing in the Welsh Council in 2004. The 2009 only fairly narrowly escaped having to become a member of the European Parliament. Rigorous is also on the very idea of sustainability.
Thanks, John. Well, it really is a great pleasure to be here today. Sorry I wasn't able to be at the last session. I'm actually not 100%, so I was actually lying down in bed asleep. But it's obvious to me from the two sessions I attended this morning what great quality we have here. It's a pleasure to be among such friends and colleagues who are obviously really thinking so seriously about these issues, which could not be more important. I'm also very happy to be here at this event that John has co-organised. As some of you may be able to tell, the title of my talk today is influenced by John's work. Those of you who haven't read John's book, Sustainability Mirage, I do strongly recommend you to do so. This talk that I'm, that's entirely unprompted and unbribed and so on. This talk that I'm going to give this afternoon is very much work in progress, so please feel free to be as critical as you need to be, and please be a little bit charitable and generous if you can to the rough edges. The ideas from it will probably mostly end up in the book I'm working on at the moment, which has the provisional title, The End of Liberalism and the Dawn of Permanent Culture. So, let's turn to sustainability. So you've got handouts here. I'll take you through sort of the broad outline of what I'm going to be talking about. So what's wrong with sustainability? Well, sustainability is a jargon term. Most people have no idea what it means. They don't like it. They find it alienating. It tends to be empty and vacuous, especially nowadays. It's used enormously by companies and governments for greenwashing purposes. But there's a deeper problem. Sustainability, if we're not very careful, is about keeping something going, about sustaining something. But what if what we're trying to keep going is itself the problem or part of the problem? And I think this is at the very least a grave rhetorical danger that is always present to the term sustainable or sustainability. One way you can see this rhetorical danger in full force is in the way that some companies and councils use phrases like sustainable more or less equivalently with economically sustainable. And when they say economically sustainable, they don't mean ecologically economically sustainable, they just mean neoclassically or neoliberally economically sustainable. So sustainability is a term that risks simply involving our current system staggering on forward for a little while longer. And what if the system actually needs to be replaced with another? What if we need a revolution? What if we need a paradigm shift? Then I fear the term sustainability ill serves us. The term sustainability ought to be about actually being able to sustain ourselves as part of sentient life and as part of the ecosystem indefinitely into the future. So what I'm saying is it's not enough merely to be able to keep the current system staggering forward for another generation. The system needs to become, we say, sustainable for the long term. But this will require a revolution, I'm suggesting, not mere reform. Thus, we have to give up the aspiration of sustaining anything actually like the present system. We need instead a green ecological economics revolution, a radical transition to resilience, a reversal of corporate globalization, its replacement by localization, a radical downsizing, move to zero waste, which will require a partial deindustrialization, the adoption of permacultural principles, etc., etc. I'll return to these points. But there's a deeper problem. And I'm trying to index that problem on the handout when I introduced the Brundtland definition of sustainable development and asked these two questions: what's wrong with sustainable development and what's wrong with development? So let's start with what's wrong with development, because development was the term that came first, let's remember, in this context. Development is supposed to be qualitative improvement. It ought not to be debased into meaning simply growth. Development means or ought to mean progress in the true sense of that word or concept. Real progress. Not just technological improvement, unless that improvement actually improves people's quality of life. Recalling like this the true sense of the word development can also throw into question the appropriateness of the description of countries such as Britain as developed. Have we really arrived? Are we really a secure telos to which developing countries ought to aspire? Aren't we in fact all developing countries, really? Shouldn't we at least aspire to be continuing to develop? Questions like these bring out, I think, the utter hubris of the concept of development, the absurdity of pretending that we know the direction of travel that we ought to be moving in, and that we've already traveled a long way down that road, a sort of faux Hegelianism. What if our development has actually hastened our world's complete devastation? But then we have to ask, is the very idea of development that we operate with best dispensed with? Should we be trying to develop the majority world at all? I'm thinking here, for example, of Helena Norberg Hodges' wonderful book, Ancient Futures, in which she promulgates the concept of counter-development. Is sustainable development in practice another way of talking about speeded up mutual assured destruction? So much for development. So what's wrong with sustainable development? Well, we can then say the first thing that's perhaps wrong with sustainable development is that development is undesirable. But there's a deeper problem. I want to suggest to you that the Brundtland definition of sustainable development tacitly privileges the present. Take a look at it. Development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. I want to suggest that this definition tacitly assumes that we need to export and reform rather than revolutionize something like our current system, that they, and perhaps we, need to develop. And I want to suggest that there's a problem with the concept of needs incorporated in the definition, namely that the concept is not defined. The concept of needs itself, I think, needs radically reconceiving. Taking away, I shall suggest, from a liberal reading thereof, in which the present and ultimately individuals determine their own needs. And this is why I've set the Brundtland definition here alongside the famous proviso of John Locke's. So Locke's proviso: an individual can legitimately create personal property in the bounties of nature only so long as there is enough and as good left in common for others. That last bit, actually, enough and as good left in common for others, actually seems to be slightly better than anything that we actually see in the Brundtland definition. What the two definitions have in common is a presumption of freedom, and I want to suggest also a tacit presumption privileging the present over the future. So this kind of presentism and this presumption of freedom is a serious problem, I believe, in Locke's proviso, and I think when you put the two side by side, it is remarkable how similar they look. One might describe a situation like this. We have a Brundtland proviso for development to be sustainable and fair, and we have a Locke proviso for development to be sustainable and fair. If there's a problem with Locke's proviso, there's going to be a problem with Brundtland's too. And I think there is a fundamental problem with Locke's proviso that I've already indicated. I think the real underlying problem is liberalism itself. Liberalism doesn't allow for most needs to be proprietorially understood except through the lens of being seen as essentially self-started wants or interests. The individual is taken to be the best judge of most of what they themselves need. I'm thinking here, for example, of Rawls's famous conception of neutrality between conceptions of the good. And liberalism is a problem because it is a driver away from ecology. People are trying very hard at the moment. There's a cottage industry of people trying to suggest that liberalism can be made compatible with ecology. But even if that succeeds, which I'm quite confident it won't, it would still be true that liberalism, as it were, itself pointed the wrong direction and made ecology harder. This is because of the presumption of freedom, which means that it starts in the wrong place, and the presumption of property, which is, of course, itself a presentist notion. For an interesting and, I think, telling illustration, contrast the idea of taking property in the Earth's atmosphere with the idea of treating the Earth's atmosphere as a commons to be shared and stewarded equally. They might for quite a long time have exactly the same policy consequences, these two conceptions, But they are fundamentally different. And one way you can see that they're fundamentally different is if you imagine a future in which it becomes possible for people to sequester, as it were, their own particular bit of the atmosphere, well then on the proprietarian notion of the atmosphere, it would be prima facie legitimate for the property holders to destroy their little bit of the atmosphere if they were so minded. But I take it, it's pretty obvious to us that that would not and could not ever be a legitimate thing to do. We mustn't think of taking property in the atmosphere and producing property rights in it. We must think of it truly as a commons, and that's something which liberalism is peculiarly ill-fitted to do, and even if it can be made to do, it points in the opposite direction. So I want to suggest that liberalism has the kind of problems that I've indicated there briefly on the handout, subordinating the concept of needs to the concept of wants or best interests, a problematic neutrality between conceptions of the good that feeds into a presumption of freedom and a presumption of property. I would suggest that Brundtland is roughly equivalent to Locke, and so much the worse for Brundtland. So that's the fundamental problem I want to suggest with sustainable development. Now let's go into this a little more. Where does this problem spring from? Well, one place it springs from is from the limits to growth and the unsuitability of liberalism for being a philosophy that acknowledges limits to growth. I'm talking about ecological and social limits to growth. Why do people want growth? Well, people want growth because they think it enables people to satisfy their needs. Yes, that term again. And these needs are often tacitly figured as potentially ever-expanding, potentially infinite. We need instead to specify them, as I've already suggested, and to understand them as essentially finite. And if we have such conception of a limit to needs, it will be easier for us to come to terms with what we absolutely must come to terms with, limits to growth. But there's something else as well here, which I've put under the heading limits to justice on your handout. What do I mean by this? Well, liberalism in its modern, in its recent form, is of course tightly tied to the concept of justice. Rawls famously remarks, justice is the first virtue of social institutions. Rawls tries to work out what to do for future people on the basis of justice. That's why he talks about just savings. As John remarked to us this morning, this doesn't spring from the mainstream of his theory, and that itself is, in my view, a problem, but he still attempts to understand how to think of future people through the prism of justice. I think that the privileging of justice is a tacit privileging of autonomous agents. It's a tacit privileging of those that can contract. And I want to try to illustrate this by dwelling for a moment on the term climate justice, which we've already touched on here today. I think this term is problematic. When we talk about climate justice, who or what are we seeking justice for? Are we seeking justice for the climate? Obviously not. Are we seeking justice for trees? I don't think so. Are we seeking justice for squirrels? No, I don't think so. Are we seeking justice for future people? Well, you can just about stretch the concept of climate justice to suggest that what it's really about is the interest of future people. I want to suggest that actually the most natural place for the concept of climate justice is in looking for justice for the people of the majority world. Now, today. And that's great, that's fine, that's very important. But it is by no means the only thing, and probably not even the most important thing, that we need to be doing in this neck of the woods. When we are doing climate philosophy, and when we are trying to do right vis-a-vis the climate, I put it to you that the term climate justice sets us off on the wrong foot. It sets us off essentially on a liberal foot, and suggests that what we ought to be doing is trying to ensure the same kind of rights and privileges for other autonomous agents in the majority world as we do for ourselves. And that's fine as far as it goes, but it does not go nearly far enough. Again, I want to suggest that liberalism is just the wrong starting point for thinking about the non-human, for thinking about the future, for thinking about vast long-term threats like climate catastrophe. So, if there's something wrong with justice, how ought we to start thinking instead? Well, I want to introduce at this point the idea of seeking to regard future people as our equals. Now, I fully accept the points that John was making this morning, I embrace them, about the certain senses in which it doesn't make sense, or it doesn't make good sense, to think of egalitarianism with regard to future people. But I do nevertheless think that the idea of treating future people as our equals gets us off in the right foot in the following way. It gets us off on the right foot in the sense of not giving us any elbow room for treating ourselves as superior to future people. Essentially this boils down, or can be seen to boil down, to not discounting the future and not harming future people. I think that there will be a civil rights revolution that will come that will start to treat future people, including in the courts, in something like the kind of relatively egalitarian way in this regard of not harming them and not subordinating them, that we already are treating people from ethnic minorities and women and so on and so forth. Equality with future people, in this sense, needs to translate into a recognition of their utter dependence on us. And that obviously introduces a huge and completely unavoidable asymmetry. And this asymmetry, I think, is what makes justice-style thinking extremely inappropriate. And the analogy that I like to use at this point is with one's children. So if one has a newborn child, and if one says, right, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to treat this child justly. I'm going to treat them fairly. And so, for example, if I have a limited quantity of food to divide between me and the child, I'll divide that according to principles of justice and fairness. I think such parents should have their children taken away from them. But this seems to be the model of child rearing that, that liberalism considered strictly as a political philosophy of justice would actually recommend to us. And this to me suggests a complete failure, and suggests that actually the concept of love and or the concept of care is what we actually need hereabouts. And what we need to do is to take this concept and extend it beyond our own immediate children to our descendants in general, to the future in general, to future people, to future generations in general. And that's going to be a challenging process psychologically, socially, and politically. But it is an absolutely essential one because of the width and gravity and global dimension, as with dangerous climate change, of the threats and also the opportunities that we now face. So, what I'm suggesting could be put in this way, that it is in fact love and not justice that is the first virtue of social institutions, especially now in an age of global threats. And I say that because it seems to me that any society which does not take as its first priority what is going to happen to the generations that come after it, how it as a society is going to continue into the future, is a deeply inadequate society, and in a certain sense not really a society at all. So it's for that reason that I want to say that it's love and not justice that is determinative if there is any such thing as the first virtue of social institutions. And this, of course, is to directly disagree with what Rawls has said. Now, it can seem strange to say this. It can sound very kind of perhaps utopian. I'll come back to that. It can sound kind of jarring to say that our society ought to be based on love and not on justice. Let me just mention a couple of points about that. That it sounds strange is, I believe, a mark of how far we've fallen and of what a difficult situation we are in and how much we have to do if we are to put in ourselves in a position of being able to save ourselves and our collective children. What I would also say is that it wouldn't sound so strange to many great social reformers. Obviously, it wouldn't sound so strange to the leaders of many revolutions, such as Jesus, but also of political revolutions, such as Che or Gandhi. And perhaps we should think more often of that. Perhaps we should think more often, for example, of Che's remark that that for any revolutionary, his actions spring really from love. So, what I want to suggest is that society, as Burke, among others, also taught us, is something that exists across long reaches of time. justice, it seems to me, is a concept designed for a given time, or perhaps for a generation, or at the very most, for one person's lifetime. Justice for the dead, it seems to me, is a meaningless concept. But I totally agree with John that there are things that we owe the dead. Justice for the unborn is, I think, little more meaningful than justice for the dead. But we owe, I would like to say, the unborn a very great deal indeed. And our society, as I suggest, barely deserves to be called one at all if it does not place as its first priority taking care of the future beyond any call of that is licensed by justice. We can see in the arbitrariness by his own lights of Rawls's introduction of obligations to future generations on the model that John presented to us this morning, we can see the way that justice is limited and fails to rise to the challenge of thinking adequately about the future. Rawls's system of thought basically quintessentially begins with us and then has to have the future tacked on as a kind of afterthought, which he tries to channel into the form of justice, to some extent succeeds, but even to the extent that he succeeds, it seems to me, completely fails to do, as it were, justice to what we owe to the future. So I want to suggest that we need to reverse the order of priority in Brundtland and Locke. Love and care for future people, being sure to safeguard for them a flourishing ecosystem, and looking after ourselves within those constraints, that is the order things ought to come in. Not starting by meeting our own needs and then saying, well, of course, we mustn't trample on the others or those who are coming after us as well. No, they should come first. This is to counter partiality, as John suggested, but also to make the future better. For me to have had a good life is, for me, to have left the world better than it was before. And again, here I'm echoing John. And I'm inclined at this point to draw a couple of quick graphs. So here are a couple of societies, and this is time. So society A, things start off wonderfully. This latest access represents resources or something like that. Things start off wonderfully, and they gradually decline to a point of extinction. And in this society, things start off not very well, and they gradually go up to a wonderful point, and then suddenly there's an extinction. Sorry, that's supposed to be the same place as that one. So the total area of the graph is the same. So which society is better? It seems to me self-evident that this society is the better one. Another way around you could put this is by saying that actually, if this line were just like this, right, so a much smaller area of the graph than this one, it might be just as good. And this is an idea which it seems to be that economists can make little sense of, and it's not clear that that Rawlsians can make sense of it either. So, Brundtland covertly privileges the present, and at best gives lip service to something like justice or fairness for the future. But I suggested that that's not enough. It's not just that Brundtland, then, has been betrayed and evacuated. What Brundtland was aiming for was itself utterly inadequate. It was wrong. Sustainable development is not desirable as an objective. We have to aim higher. Sustainable development is part of a package with liberalism, with growthism, with an industrial northern hubris, with a failed reformist package. It's not then just that, unsurprisingly, it hasn't been achieved. Is that the very idea gives us the wrong idea. So what do we need instead? Well, we need an alternative package, which I've gestured at in the last bullet point on your handout. This alternative package must start with a really honest awareness of the limits to growth, built into a genuinely ecological economics. So, for example, with carbon rationing, with perhaps contraction convergence without offsets, or better still, perhaps greenhouse development rights, which go some way to answering the question that came up in John's talk this morning about, where do you put the distinction between basic emissions and luxury emissions. The Greenhouse Development Rights Framework attempts to answer that question. And if we do have something like contraction and convergence, then it should be really taken seriously that the global commons is a commons, and that anything that looks like property rights in it are not really to be regarded as property rights. I call this ideology commonsism, not communism, commonsism. And as I've already suggested, the idea of limits to growth needs to go along with an idea of limits to needs, and that idea needs to be worked out, and we need to actually start to specify what those needs are. Human beings and their needs are not, as an intriguing current movie helps us to see, limitless. Does the concept of capabilities offer some hope or promise here? Well, I think it offers some, but only some. Most of the time when I read Sen, it seems to me that actually he's made much less progress on from liberalism than some people are supposing, partly because it doesn't seem as though he's actually built in any sort of endpoint to these capabilities. They seem to be potentially endlessly expansible in the way that that wants and needs under liberalism and under sustainable development are. We need, I'm suggesting, to turn back liberalism. We need to foster community, society, democracy, and equality instead. I suggest that a liberal society guarantees inequality. I think it's one of the great propagandistic achievements of modern philosophy that Rawls has become regarded as an egalitarian, when actually his founding achievement is to justify inequality. And a liberal society, I suggest, has no real demos. It doesn't really form a people at all, and you can see this very clearly in the later Rawls. So it isn't really, in the most meaningful sense of the word, which is a sense we should be striving for, a society at all. This is obviously connected with the idea of turning back from the presumption of freedom. So obviously there's a philosophical task here. One could even go further. I think that as philosophers we should be trying to think about the concept of something like a collective political virtue ethics. The problem with too much virtue ethics is that while it has acknowledged the importance of humans as social animals, it hasn't said enough beyond the idea of virtues as individual properties or achievements. I think we need some kind of generally collective virtue ethics that is interested in the virtues of societies or communities worthy of the name, whether those virtues be bravery or temperance or whatever. New ones, perhaps, collective virtues. We may also have to think about not just collective responsibility, but ultimately some sense of collective personality. And we have to obviously foster, as I suggested, solidarity or equality with future people, in a specific sense that I suggested, not, I think, in great tension with anything that John said this morning, because what this actually moves into, once one has achieved the very basic thing that we have not as yet achieved, namely moving beyond subordinating future people to ourselves, what this actually starts to amount to then is love for future people, because of the complete asymmetry in which we find ourselves with regard to them, and vice versa, their total dependence upon us. And in fact, I would go further and to say that this love should be love for all voiceless and all powerless ones. I have a kind of policy, a proposal, which we could talk about if people are interested, for how we might start to move in this direction. My idea is for powerful guardians for the interests of all of the voiceless, guardians that would be selected at random from the population and that would operate in a deliberative or discursively democratic fashion. This, I think, would be, if we were to create such an institution as part of our democracy, then I think we would start to become worthy of the name democracy, because after all, don't the people include future people too? The guardians would stand for and represent the basic needs of future people and similarly of other voiceless constituencies such as non-human animals. And lastly, rather than talking about sustaining anything, I think we should start thinking about permanentizing culture. Not permanentizing our culture, that would be absurd, it would be a conservative ambition which I would not welcome. and it would fly in the face of recognizing the extent to which we require a revolution in our practices, a massive change in our culture. But permanentizing human culture itself, in general, as a project, what will this involve? What will this include? Well, it will certainly include something like a great transition of the kind that the New Economics Foundation have been talking about recently, or perhaps a great turning of the kind that Joanna Macy has been talking about. It will include a far more central role for permaculture. And it will probably include a great deal of moving back to the land. And here I think a hopeful development is the strength in the majority world of the Via Campesina movement. It will include, as I already mentioned, a relocalization of a very substantial nature. And this will bring with it and also need to include a massive increase in resilience, a massive reduction in supply lines. How will we preserve cosmopolitanism? How will we preserve some kind of sense of universality as these processes get underway? I think perhaps the most important way in which we will do this is through preserving and indeed enhancing, growing the communications that we have, even as we travel less and strengthen and spend more time in local communities. So I'm thinking, for example, about electronic media, obviously about Skype. I think by the time that you have a sort of three-dimensional version of Skype that you can carry around with you, which probably isn't so very far off, it won't seem to people anymore that they have to spend half their life traveling around the world, hurtling around the world pointlessly, and destroying the world in the process. We can reverse hypermobility and achieve a far greater resilience without giving up on cosmopolitanism and a kind of basic universalism, which will help us, among other things, crucially, to pay sufficient attention to global threats and global opportunities. We need in all of this to offer people a better life. Somebody said earlier, well, but if I live in the green way, then my life won't be so good, and certainly my daughter's life won't be so good. Well, we need to make sure that, to the extent possible, and I think it is possible, that isn't true. And we need people to realize that, for example, the massive increase in throughput and economic growth over the past generation has, in fact, all the evidence suggests, made people less happy rather than more happy. But as well as looking for a better life now, we absolutely need, and we cannot avoid, a commitment to long-termism, to far-sightedness, to love for those who come after us. And we're well suited to this, I think, because we're mammals. So we know what it is to care for our families. We know what it is to think that nothing could be more important for us than those who come after us. What we have to recognize is that we can't do it in our own families anymore. So thinking of John's story of himself and his daughter. Maybe you don't give yourself enough credit, John, when you say that actually your most important accomplishment has been your kids. You know, maybe there's something that you have achieved in your public life, in your intellectual life, and so on, which is more important. It's very hard to compare, very hard to know. But if it is true of most of us that the most important thing that we've achieved is taking care of our own children, then so much the worse for us, because that's not good enough anymore. What we actually have to do is to make this shift from caring for our own children to caring for the future in general, to loving it, to loving them, loving the future people. We will not save ourselves now without the most bold ambitions, not just ambitions to make our own lives better through downsizing and downscaling and reducing hypermobility and so on, but through doing what is necessary to save the future. All this talk about love, once again, one last time I want to remark, sits very strangely alongside the cold liberal impersonality of concepts like justice. This liberal impersonality that seems tolerant, but that actually fosters indifference. Once again, I take it that this is an index of the depth and breadth of the change, the revolution that we need to undertake. So as I gestured at earlier, when I say this kind of thing, people often say, well, Rupert, you're being utopian. And this term utopian in such a context is intended as a term of criticism. Well, my response to that claim is this. I don't think it is utopian to say that the very idea of sustainability is inadequate and we have to move beyond it in the ways that I sketched in this talk. On the contrary, I think that what is utopian in the problematic sense of that word, in the sense of that word in which it is used as a term of criticism, is to think that liberalism and any reformed version thereof, including even if we were to achieve the ambitions of sustainable development, would potentially save us. I think it is now clear that it will not. So actually, in the problematic sense of the word, utopian, in the sense of the word in which it is used as a term of criticism, it is utopian to think that anything less than aiming for a genuine utopia is now what is necessary. What we need to do now, the only chance that we have of actually having a better future, is to aim in the positive sense for utopia. And that's what I've been trying to suggest we do, and how I've been trying to suggest that we do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Rupert. I mean, Rupert has exhibited a virtue rare, I think almost a uniqueness of our academic speakers, and he hasn't used up all his time, so we've got the opportunity for quite a wide-ranging discussion now, as it not supposed to be. I'm going to start with points arising out of each presentation. Maybe we can then broaden it out to sort of take in some of the things that we've been starting to do in the course of the day. So maybe in the back there. Just say who you are.
Hi, just one little thing about talking to you about love. I'm a 5-year-old and she talks about, she's made the distinction between public and private, and she says love is something in the private sphere, the equivalent in the public sphere of solidarity. So perhaps solidarity is not their focus. And for my, you're talking about the love of children and that sort of thing. I mean, having a child, having a baby, a loving a baby, is very different. An actual baby that you've got is very different from some sort of vague notion of some abstract children that you're going to have someday in the future. So I think love for concrete people that you know is just so different from love for, I think it's a completely different sense of, even love that for existence, saying that you love everybody debases the idea of love. So that's what it is. So I don't think it's the right, it's the right word. I do, though, think that you could talk about love of the world, and loving places. And perhaps this is, in terms of leaving the world a better place, perhaps that's how we should think about, rather than thinking about loving people in the future, we can love the things that we know now, and love the places and nature and buildings or whatever, and want to seek to preserve them, and which also has been touched on.
Do you want to respond point by point, or shall we collect some thoughts?
Well, there's quite a lot there, actually. thank you, Anne. Loving the world, I totally agree. And loving life. But I do want to also make this other claim, this further claim that you don't want to make. Let me just say a little bit more about why. So you say that loving everybody is kind of debases love or is impossible or something like that. Well, I'm not sure. I don't think so. I think it's very challenging, but I think that it's possible. I think we think that there are saints who have done it. So then in a way, what I'm saying might put us, well, I think we need to all be a lot more like saints. Now, traditionally in moral philosophy, saying something like that has a very bad name. People say, you can't kind of require supererogatory acts of everybody. I think you can ask for them. And I think that it may well be possible that we are now living in a time in which, unless nearly everybody manages to practice at least quite a lot of supererogation, then we are all doomed. So if that's the case, then I think we should ask for a widespread supererogation. And this is part of what makes the time that we live in so completely terrifying and so completely exciting. You know, what I'm trying to suggest is that we really do face now a pretty stark choice, as I put it at the end of my talk. Either we aim full-headedly for utopia, or we might as well just give up. You know, we might as well just keep Drax burning and drive fast cars or whatever we feel like. It's pointless to do these kind of half measures of sustainable development, etc., etc. It's pointless. So I think it's possible, but very challenging, to love everybody. I've tried to practice it myself, for example. An interesting thing that I sometimes do is if I'm for example in a waiting somewhere, like in a doctor's surgery or something, you know, there's awful places where there are just those magazines. You think, oh God, am I going to really bear to spend even 5 minutes with those magazines? If I haven't remembered, as I usually fail to remember, to bring along my own magazines and to leave them there scattered about, then I sometimes kind of look around the room and kind of one person at a time try to cultivate in myself an attitude, a feeling of love towards that person, and I may kind of say it in a kind of mantra-like way, and try to kind of be ready to act upon it should the occasion arise, whether it be just through a smile, or possibly, if it very rarely happens, of course, something more drastic. So you said, based on our end, maybe we only need solidarity and not love. I mean, I'm all in favour of solidarity, and I use the term solidarity a couple of times, as you may have noticed, in my talk. But I'm not convinced that solidarity is enough. As you'll have gathered, the suggestion that I've made is the concrete love that we do feel for concrete others needs to be extended into a generalized love that we feel for generalized others. Now you'll say, ah yes, but we can't really feel love for generalized others if they're faceless, if you don't have a relationship with them. Well, again, those relationships can be cultivated. So for example, there are deep ecologists, for example, Joanna Macy, who have concrete practices for trying to make future people concrete to you. And I've experienced them, and they're extremely powerful. And you can start to feel as though you're actually in a relationship with people who are the distant unborn. Now, as John would emphasize, there's something always potentially problematic or dangerous about such imaginative practices. The danger is that one will start to think that it actually isn't all dependent upon you and upon the meaningfulness of things now in the present. A relationship that I have with an imagined concrete other is not, we might say, a concrete relationship. But I want to say that there are ways in which one can concretize the future for oneself. There are ways in which one can concretize the faceless and the voiceless. I think we should thoroughly embrace those ways. I think they should enter into our education system. Again, I think that that's likely to be the kind of thing that actually gives us a chance.
We've got quite a few now, so Mark.
I agree with what you said, including the emphasis on government, raising bits and pieces. I would argue the problem is less with Locke than his disciples, because Locke does contextualise intellectual property in a virtue framework. But from the back of the context, you talk about greenness. And I would argue that the bigger problem is Bacon and New Lattice. Bacon is an utopia. It's actually the ultimate dystopia, but in the other way, actually, he was living in. That's not quite what he does. A few of the things, property can be limited by supposed to be common good. Justice. You can do justice to non-humans, and there's a sort of literature out there that's actually very much to do. Just to mention, when you're talking about law, there are models of what law is, and the best one is C.S. Lewis's Law. There's other stuff out there, but that would be a... tradition, you know, it's not a contestable model, but to delineate different sorts of my outlook, clarify in terms of, you know, make criticisms more directed rather than, because love is a very abused term.
Thanks for that. I'm with you on C.S. Lewis. That's a helpful thought. Is the problem Bacon rather than Locke? Well, look, I'm not saying that... I don't think that... This is what I think. I think you're right. Bacon is just truly appalling. You just read Bacon, your skin kind of crawls, and you think, Christ, no wonder we're in such a total disaster of a mess. The reason I like to focus on people like Locke and Rawls and Brundtland, for that matter, is that we kind of think, oh yeah, there's awful people like Bacon and so on. And then there's these people who are actually, you know, quite reasonable, like Locke and Rawls, and maybe we kind of don't get it all right, but maybe they're kind of partly on the right track. And what I want to say is, I'm afraid not. These people are the acceptable face of the bastards, basically. You know? And what somebody like Rawls does is he provides a tacit legitimation for the ideas and the practices of people like Hayek and Friedman. And what Rawls does also is he enables people to think of themselves as being left-wing and egalitarian when actually they're just apologists for the status quo. And what Rawls does is he comes over as this terribly kind of nice and reasonable kind of person, such that you get the sort of Tony Blair problem where Blair says, you know, come on, trust me, I'm a pretty straight guy, I'm at least credit me with being sincere, etc. You know, I'm at least trying to do the right thing, etc. And, you know, these people should face up to the consequences of their words and of their actions. So I agree with you that you can get quite a lot of good stuff out of Locke. But what I'm suggesting is it's really dangerous stuff. You can get quite a lot of good stuff out of Rawls, but it's really dangerous. You say property can be limited. Absolutely, it can be limited. One of the key points I was making in my talk is you can constrain property into a framework so that it works for us. You can constrain liberty and liberalism into frameworks such that they work for us. But you have to constrain them. Right? And that's not where we want to be. Right? What we need to be is in a situation where our founding concepts and ideas are working for us, rather than working against us and always needing to be constrained. So what I've been trying to do is to sketch out dimensions of a framework where it wouldn't be that we were always jumping from one frying pan into the fire. We wouldn't be always pushing up against the limits of growth and threatening to rupture them. We would actually be setting ourselves on a path which, while it would be extremely demanding in all sorts of ways to do with the demands of love and so on and so forth, it would actually at least be a framework and a set of concepts that we could think to ourselves, if we get this right, it actually is going to be okay. Whereas you can make Locke and Rawls as good as they can be, you can make Brundtland as good as she can be, as it were, and I think it still won't be all right. Lastly, justice to non-humans, you'll talk about Earth justice and so on and so forth. I just don't really buy it. I don't think this is going to work. I don't think it's going to fly. I think that, for example, Christopher Stone's idea of giving trees standing—it's never going to work. Well, yeah. I mean, well, look. Obviously, you can. It's absolutely crucial to, one of the crucial dimensions of our relations to non-humans, right, is to, as many thinkers have suggested, is a virtue dimension. That's absolutely clear. I think it's a lot less clear that the relevant virtue is justice. And I actually find it very forced. Just as I find it forced to talk about giving trees standing, forced to talk about earth justice or earth democracy, etc. It seems to me that what we need to do is be clear about what it makes sense for us to love and what it makes sense for us to be just towards. And I think it's clear that it makes sense for us to love a much wider set of things than it makes sense for us to be just towards. Very roughly speaking, it seems to me that talk of being just towards something is always forced and problematic if the thing in question doesn't itself have any sense whatsoever of justice. Maybe, I mean, Do you want to have a quick comeback on that?
I guess that'll come up tomorrow.
Matt, we'll talk about it.
Matt Campbell from Australia. Rupert, I want to interrogate you a little more about what you mean by love, because you're proposing, let's accept, for example, that you convinced us that, that your arguments are sound concerning the replacement of love as the first virtue of social institutions, rather than justice.
Yeah.
Okay. How is it, I'd like you to sort of help me to think about how this is going to flesh out in terms of policies and procedures of public institutions as well as our social institutions. The sorts of things that our public institutions seem to do are compel imputation, to compel compliance and acquiescence, and to compel constraint. And by compelling those things, we're kept safe in our beds, our property is kept safe, and our relationship with resources, our day-to-day lives, work fairly well. And social order and prosperity will collapse, we know, if those activities, which are currently framed in terms of justice, we can look at how those activities look just and say, okay, but they clearly, within a telos of domination and appropriation that's dominated our entire culture as well as our entire institutional telos, if you like. That is to say, there might be people who individually say, I'd love to love, but my hands are tied. It's the system. There's nothing I can do. So people are compelled by the telos within to do the marginalising and to compel the imputation that our culture expects officially. So, if we're to replace with love, would you want to use words like compelling respect or inclusion? I'm thinking of the kind of story we get from Stone in Treatise of Standing, that there's a kind of history of progression concerning rights. Would you imagine a history of progression of the same kind of story told in terms of love?
That's a lovely question, that last bit. I'll have to think about that. Let me first say that when I talk about love as a candidate for first virtue of social institutions, I'm not at all sure, by the way, this idea of first virtue is really any good at all. I'm just borrowing it from Rawls and suggesting if we are going to talk about first virtue, he's picked a bad one. Of course, first virtue doesn't mean only virtue. So, for example, I wouldn't envisage that in my utopia there would be no law courts and no punishment and no settlement of disputes, etc. What I would envisage would be this, that the first principle in every such institution would be to think of how this, whatever this is, affects the future children, future generations, the powerless, the voiceless in general. So, for example, one thing which that would quickly bring out would be, well, what kind of thing are we modelling here? And what are we tacitly suggesting to people are ways to aspire to be by the way we set up this institution? And that, I think, is a really important question which we could actually learn a lot from and which would change some of what we do. For example, I think it would make us far more likely within, as it were, the sphere of justice to move towards restorative justice wherever possible. But also, as I hinted in my talk, it seems to me there'd have to be actual kind of institutional and political mechanisms for putting us in the best possible position to ensure that we did not violate the basic needs of the future in the decisions that we were making. So, for example, if we had my guardians in place, what they would do is that every decision over the bringing into being of a law at local and national level, so, and major administrative decisions as well, would be assessed for its by the guardians with expert assistance for its impact upon future people, and this would be a hurdle it would have to pass. If it didn't pass this hurdle, it wouldn't even be considered. And I think that idea would hugely change the way that we think about our deliberative democracy and our priorities in general. It would mean, for example, that civil servants would always have to think from the start, okay, so now how is this going to affect the basic needs of future people? How is this going to affect future generations? And unless they could see a way in which what they were thinking about was going to affect them positively, or at least not affect them negatively, they wouldn't even consider it. And the guardians themselves would be they would take some kind of oath to swear themselves to represent and care for, to the absolute best of their abilities, the entirety of the future of humanity, or entirety of the future of humanity within their country, or something like that. So they would themselves be kind of living, powerful exemplars of this spirit of love and care. And I think this would make a huge difference to our culture. Lastly, to answer your question a little bit more directly, yes, I think if we did think of love as something like the first virtue of social institutions, this would then make a difference to the way in which we conceived of our institutions in general. So, for example, in situations where it was clear that love was absent. So a classic example would be something like two people wanting to determine to get divorced, or where at least it wasn't enough present, or something like that. I think we would try to structure the institutions and situations in question as much as possible to foster love and caringness, even in the face of its absence. And to try to show some kind of space for its ongoing possibility, rather than simply treating it as a kind of complete irrelevance, as something that we're sort of embarrassed to mention in polite public conversation. By the way, of course, it is striking that love is already present in some aspects of our public conversation. So one example is, of course, the marriage ceremony. Another example which I quite like is in France, there are these street signs that show pictures of lovely pictures of lovely little children on them. And the caption is beneath it. It's a road safety campaign. It's all across France. It says, Aimez les enfants. And of course, those of you who know French know that, strictly speaking, aimer doesn't necessarily get translated as love. But it kind of means more than the English term like. It means sort of like slash love. It means it's quite a strong word to use pretty much in any context, except when you don't really mean it in France. I take these street signs to be saying something like, look, you really ought to care for the little children. You know, this ought to be in your mind right now while you're driving. And what I'm saying is kind of, well, if it's going to be in your mind right now when you're driving, then why shouldn't it be in your mind when you're also doing things like making laws and structuring social institutions and so on and so forth? I think it should.
So things like value, respect, include, and so on go with that.
Absolutely, and there's a whole family here. And you know, it might be that love is the wrong term, it might be that it's too strong or something, but it seems to me that at least thinking this through in terms of something like love or a kind of deep care is a good place to start, to really challenge the prejudices I think we now have on the basis of a large, quasi-anonymous, cosmopolitan society. Prejudices that I think are not serving us well anymore.
I was worried for a lot of it that I'd agree with it.
And there's two places where I kind of disagree. I mean, one is just going to come back to the same point that Anne started, but it's the concept of love. I mean, my kind of, you should love everyone. Example of that was Aristotle against Plato, where, you know, Plato has this kind of generalized love of the family, so you don't have any particular, and Aristotle says better a real cousin than a platonic brother, and I think it's and what he's getting at is that, you know, certain kind of special relations are to particular others, and it's really important that there's particular others, and I think most of them are actually. And even when you talk about concretizing, and I don't know what that involves, but it's like making it like something that you have to a particular other, and that's primary. Uh-huh. And I think having that notion of love as primary relationship to particulars is really important. If you go to a generalized abstract of love, you've kind of lost a really important part of ethical life, which is actually quite important and foundations. And it has you then get the relationship between loving your children and having other duties to others, right? And I think that gets, you don't want to be the mafia when everything just becomes about that. So I wouldn't want to have love as the first virtue, but I think there are, in solidarity is one, I think care is one. I think Aristotle talks about friendship, like civic friendship, being prior to justice, and I think he's right about that as well. I think unless you've got some kind of notion of civic friendship, justice doesn't even arise. So I think there's a whole series of other concepts, but love and right, so that's where... The other is that I'd be a bit kinder to Brooklyn, in the sense that I think you make a move in here, which she doesn't do, right? I mean, Brooklyn says, I mean, the commitment to sustainability is about needs, it's all about needs. And there's a second part to that, which people don't work, is that the needs of the poorest now take priority over other needs, which is also in... And her definition is very much in terms of need. I think the shift from to want really comes from later economists. Right? And what I try to do is almost the opposite, to say let's go back to Brooklyn, and let's go back to the concept of need here, and let's think about what's... And I then want to think about different kinds of needs. I won't just think of basic needs, but why I like David Wiggins, the idea of non-instrumental or categorical needs. Because basic needs are kind of needs based on your biological nature. There's lots of other needs that you have based on your social nature, which are cultural, which you also want to include in that. So I want to return to the concept of needs, but use something like categorical or non-instrumental needs or absolute needs rather than basic needs. And let that do the work. But I would also say that's a virtual problem, so I wouldn't want to throw Brooklyn down too quickly here. I think she's got a rhetorical power against the way sustainability has been developed since, which is purely in terms of preference. Without any
point of disagreement. Yeah. thanks a lot, John. That's a couple of lovely points. Let's take the second one first. You might be right. I guess the main reason I suspect still that you're not is that I still have this sense that Brundtland, like Locke, actually tacitly does put the present first. And even if it's done in terms of needs, what I'm saying is that's not good enough. What we actually ought to be thinking is, no, what society is really about is about taking care of the future. And then within that constraint, we take care of ourselves. And that is a crucial kind of change of view or change of gestalt.
No, I can take that point. I think that's a nice point. But I just want to say, in terms of the needs point, I mean, you have to understand the needs of the poorest thing as well.
Yeah. Yeah, but of course that runs the risk of just being rules. And what that actually then amounts to is things like trickle-down economics.
Yeah, no, you know? Well, not necessarily.
Not necessarily, of course. But the question is, is there any good argument from within the Rawlsian system to say that trickle-down economics cannot be Rawlsian, cannot be just?
I haven't seen one. I agree with you, Chris, on Rawls and liberalism.
Right. Well, sure. What I'm saying is that the element of Brundtland that you pulled out in terms of the needs of the poorest must come first, that it's terribly similar to Rawls. It's terribly similar to Rawls. It sounds great. It sounds like no one could possibly disagree. But actually, it always runs the risk of licensing all sorts of appalling social arrangements. On the other point about love, as I say, I've got an open mind about this. I mean, it's possible that I'd be better off sticking with solidarity or care. I totally agree with your remark about civic friendship, by the way, absolutely foundational. Another crucial thing which is left out of liberalism. I guess though, I'm not convinced by your thought that, look, well, your thought about something like this, the concrete, particularist kind of nature of love mustn't be lost, and it will be lost if we kind of generalize and abstractify and so on and so forth. But I'm just not sure why we should think that implication follows through. What I want to say is, no, let's preserve the concrete, particularist, partialist, etc. Nature of love. Let's preserve that, and then let's expand it. Now, I would like to hear an argument for why you can't do that. Why is it not possible to achieve what you do achieve and should continue to achieve with your family on this much, much wider basis? That's what I want to suggest we need to do, and that's what I haven't heard a reason for thinking can't be done. Do you have a reason for thinking?
There's two possible arguments for that. One would be empirical, just about a fact of human psychology. So So that's you just can't, you know, there's cognitive limits to how much you can actually care about certain people in that kind of way. And I think that's true. Right. There might be, that would just be a purely kind of cognitive limitation, right, kind of creatures or whatever. But there might be, I think, a kind of a pathological problem, which is precisely about the relationship to particulars versus relationships to abstract generals. And I just think that's what we need to explore a bit when we talk about it later on. But I think that there might be just a logical difference about the kind of object of the relationship.
If I could just abuse the chair, I haven't done this much, but I mean, you asked the question. What about this? Love for future people is love for an abstraction. Yeah. And love for an abstraction is basically love for yourself. Martin, you had a point on this topic?
All right.
Said it
in a way that this kind of cognitive
and
psychological limitation, I mean, love is painful as fucking hell. If I was to extend that to 7 billion people, I'd be like... It is possible in moments, but it only lasts 4 to 6 hours and it wears off again.
Megan, we've been waiting for a very long time. There's quite a few people.
All right, I'll come back in a minute.
Yeah, you sort of collect a few.
Yeah, okay.
Megan. So I wanted to not bend calls as such because they're not causing fantastic thinking. But maybe suggest that you have to be or at least that your criticism of liberalism maybe disappears apart if we're taking more to start with paradigmatic examples. So the first one was what you talk about, how rightly we don't think that the relationship between a particular parent and child should be governed by principles of justice, but it should be governed by love. And also just that I agree with you there, because justice is the first bit of institutions, it's not supposed to apply to personal relationships, that's what you was criticised by.
But is it a family or social institution?
Family is an abstraction, I think, for laws as a social institution. So we live in a society where in all families women have to take a subordinate role. I think you would say that's a matter of justice. But if we're talking about a particular parent child, then he was criticised by Cohen for the very point that he doesn't think that's a relationship that should be governed by principles of justice. And the second point is that I think Rawls will quite clearly say that the bottom graph there is better, because not only in the top case do they fail to abide by the just saving principle, but they also have done simply avoidably so badly that they've got to say when the conditions of justice are no longer in place. And of course it's quite clear that there's this vision of progress where you have to accumulate resources until everyone's basically needs to be there, and then the principles of justice kick in. And if we get to the stage where conditions of justice are no longer there, that's a really bad thing.
That's a good point, actually, about the graphs. You may be right. Maybe it was unfair to mention Rawls there. To be honest, that was an afterthought. I was mostly thinking of economists, and I thought maybe it's the same for Rawls as well, because usually things that are true of economists are also true of Rawls, but maybe this one isn't. So thanks for that. In terms of the first point about the family, well, look, you might be right, but it doesn't really matter. The point is not what one says about the family. The point is what one's supposed to get from that as the basis of an analogy, right? What I'm doing with it is I'm saying, here's the kind of attitude one ought to have to one's family, to one's children, etc. And this attitude ought to be writ large into the future, too. Future generations are even more powerless than newborn babies. You know, they can't even scream. They're completely, abjectly dependent upon us. And it's kind of absurd and obscene to say kind of, well, they should stand on their own 2 feet, or to say, as Rawls and one or two others have done on various occasions, oh, there's a real danger that we're going to be too generous to future generations. You know, I think there's something really just appalling about that kind of mealy-mouthedness. Now, just to come back to John's point, because it's relevant. So the thought is, well, maybe there's a cognitive... I don't understand this kind of logical argument. You'll have to explain it to me. The first argument I do understand, or maybe there's just a psychological cognitive limitation. Well, I think that that's just an extremely dangerous argument. Basically, that argument's been used over and over again to say, well, human nature says that X and Y is possible. You know, conservatives use this kind of argument all the time. Why don't we try and find out? You know, why don't we actually try and find out? That's what I'm saying. And I think that, especially if I'm right in thinking that this is something like, this is a gamble that we have to take if we're going to have any chance at all, then we've got nothing to lose in trying and finding out. Of course it's going to be painful some of the time, but notice, by the way, that it's not as if we're going to have to succeed all the time in being loving to everyone who's coming after us. There are certain times when it's far more important than others to succeed at that. For example, when you're at the ballot box. If we can just succeed in being genuinely loving towards future people when we're making the most important decisions that we make, that might be enough.
Well, we have a queue, but I'm going to slightly restructure it in order to bring in some people who haven't said anything yet. So, Cherry,
thank you. I'm from the Lancaster Green Screen, and I just like to put up the idea that the notion of compassion might be a much more useful way of looking at this concept than love, with all its sort of connotations. And maybe that compassion possibly has a sort of more widespread appeal.
Yeah, so Karuna, for example. Look, again, I'm not totally wedded to love. I think that there is a slight danger that the phrase or that the word compassion has a kind of... You have to be very careful to make sure that it doesn't slide into something like pity. I'm not saying it definitely does. I'm just saying that's something one has to be careful about. That's a risk which is not so present in the concept of love, it seems to me. Well, it's very interesting the way that I'm enjoying the way we're trying these alternative phrases or concepts, solidarity, care, compassion, this afternoon. I guess one of the reasons why I kind of boldly pose the concept of love is precisely to provoke and suggest that it's part of suggesting that we actually need to do something extremely bold and ambitious. It might be that we should do something very slightly less bold and ambitious, but still pretty damn bold and ambitious. You know, I'd be pretty happy with compassion. It's a great concept.
Next to Sherry, I don't know your name.
Lauren. Yeah, I can see why the concept of love is a problem. Of course, I think it's some people here. Probably because there is no concept of love to start with. In some ways, I believe that it's non sequitur to actually try and combine concept and love together, because we're actually operating at a different level within our being. Concepts operate within the cognitive and the rational mode, and just to try and rationalize love, we're actually in some ways missing the point. But I completely agree with your disparity of where you're coming from, because maybe love is the answer, but what it's pointing to is a consciousness shift, which actually moves us some way away from this dialectic between the head and the heart. It's moving to a different order of working as an organism, where that conflict doesn't then appear, and that takes much more radical philosophy. In some ways, the Buddhist Eastern philosophies do approach the idea of those shifts, and that have done for 2,500 years.
Yeah.
For me, it feels that this argument which is going on about, oh well, a particular form of love to our children, if we widen that out, we call debases the form of love, that's because we're conflating two times. The love to talk about Eastern philosophy is not to do with the brain. It's a different order. It's to do with our understanding of ourselves at a cellular level, which is automatically a level which is somehow transpersonal, to a transpersonal dimension of ourselves, where suddenly the idea of ourselves being in connection with the future generation is totally cogent. Let's face it, our atoms that we, and our molecular ideas that we pass on, as long as you can say it is the same, we are the same people now as the people of the future and as the same people of the past. If we can connect to that reality, then we are really connected to that love of the police that we're talking about.
Thank you for that wonderful question. I'm strongly in sympathy with what you're saying. So we've got the model of parental love, and I think that is extremely useful. It's extremely widely agreed, etc., to partly counter your first worry about, well, is there really a kind of concept of love at all? I think the concept of parental love is quite a kind of foundational concept that can be widely agreed. But I totally agree with you. It's not enough to think about parental love. We ought to think also about the kind of love that is central to the great religions. And that is not a million miles away, I think, from the kind of thing that someone like Che Guevara meant by love. Love for one's comrades, revolutionary love, love for the society that one's trying to build and that will come after. I was thinking, as you were speaking, of Joanna Macy's tremendous book, which you can also get as a tapes or CDs, and I strongly recommend this to people, World as Lover, World as Self. And she's obviously coming partly from a Buddhist, a Shambhala warrior point of view, in thinking about the way that we need to find ways of overcoming our sense of alienation from our world and from those who are going to come after us. And then love will come to seem sort of completely natural, just as natural as not just hacking your right hand off. I hope that's natural for all of you. And of course what this leads into, which is a whole kind of further discussion, is the fascinating question of where we now stand as a society in relation to the great religions, or to the possibility of a shared religion or spirituality. And I think this is a very difficult question. I certainly think the attitude of liberalism towards this question is totally inadequate. The way that liberalism privatizes and suborns religion, it seems to me, is unacceptable. And it seems to me entirely possible that it may be that one of the religions that we have, or more likely some kind of new emerging, almost perhaps meta-religion or meta-spirituality, will be the kind of thing that could save us in the kind of way that we're talking about here in years to come. And insofar as liberalism makes that impossible, then liberalism again is risks signing our collective death warrant. But that's a huge kind of further discussion, how exactly we ought to situate ourselves now in relation to religion and spirituality. But I totally agree with you that in that conversation, the teachings of Buddhism, precisely perhaps because of their lower likelihood of turning problematically supernaturalistic, are exemplary.
My colour recognition is challenged now because I have mauve top and then purple top. I think that means that the next to Megan is first, and then the first two C's are often. So you first. Is that mauve? Are you wearing mauve? Is that mauve? Would you call that mauve?
I think so.
Yeah.
We were talking a while ago of totalizing a new culture.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the New Economics Foundation, Joanna Macy, who you mentioned a few minutes ago in there. And you're also talking about permaculture. A lot of these things are common in transition towns. And I'm wondering whether you would consider the transition town movement as having a role to play in permaculturing a new culture.
Yeah, definitely, yes. The problem with transition towns, and why, and I've written about this and I've argued with Bob Hopkins about it, you can find it on my blog if you want, is only that transition towns are sometimes overhyped in this regard. I think transition towns are the transition movement is a vital part of this transition, of the revolution, the great transition that we need in order to have a chance of producing a culture that could be part of a move towards permanentizing human existence on this wonderful planet. The problem is that the role of transition towns without an accompanying political movement is sometimes overhyped. So one very simple, crude way of describing that would be to say that you need at minimum something like the transition movement in concert with something like a green government. The reason why you need that is because if you only have the transition movement without something like a green government, then the short to medium term effects of that will be to encourage huge amounts of free riding. If you have, say you have transition towns across half of Britain and the rest of Britain is just going on in the same old way, well, of course, what those transition towns will then be helping to do is to make petrol cheaper for everybody else in Britain in the meantime. The transition towns without some kind of overarching political structure to complement them will send a massive economic price signal in the wrong direction. So, short answer to your question is absolutely, I think the transition movement is one crucial part of the package that I was indicating at the end of my talk. But it needs the other parts of the package as well. If the transition movement is going to succeed, it needs radical political reform or revolution to accompany it.
Ron, was yours a supplementary on this or a separate point? In which case I'll come back to you. Well, in that case,
I was kind of now dipped all in this discussion on about this thing on love. So one was I was really pleased that we kind of had justice kind of coming back in, but not necessarily the first bit.
Oh yeah, sure, yeah, absolutely.
Just by absence that we kind of gone, no, we don't like justice.
No. Like, sorry, yeah. I never meant to imply that. Yeah.
But the love thing is, I was well in favour of it. Like, just because I think it's interestingly motivational. At the time when I looked at my hand up, nobody said that yet. So I thought that in that sense, it goes fairly obviously offering a motivation why people would wish to act and not consider themselves to be burdened by the process.
Yeah.
That seemed to me to be particularly powerful. I went, go for it. Even if it's not quite the term you actually mean, I think that that comes with a set of power that seemed really useful for the type of the. For the scale of endeavour that you wanted to
yes.
take, that seemed really useful. Although, I then wondered if the type of discussion we're having suggested I was wrong, just from the pragmatic point that if people were going to argue about its impossibility, that might detract from what I thought to be this incredible.
Well, you know what they say, first they ridicule you, then they attack you, then they, what's it, then you win, yeah.
The last thing I wanted to say was I'm not sure whether or not we have an issue between this idea of love requiring a focus and then extending what that is. So there's some interesting research that's done that when we get these flyers through the post asking for money for children in third world, that you're more likely to give when there's only one story, so when there's sometimes multiple stories, and you're less likely to give if there's two children in the same photo. So like just physically the proximity to someone else reduces your ability to empathise with the individual. But I don't think that's a problem, because I think in so many of these major decisions, we can kind of go, okay, let me think about how the individuals in this would be affected, and what if one of them turned out to be my cousin George. So I don't necessarily think the fact that we're talking on the scale of 7 billion prevents us creating those individual links that give us the motivation to them.
Yeah, I think that's right. Just very briefly, if you look at films like Children of Men or Avatar, these films focus on groups, and they focus on the species, and they focus on individuals. And the individual focus on the individual is a crucial part of them, but the individual stands in for the group and stands in for the species. So that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about midwifing a massive, large-scale transformation, but doing so crucially by concretizing along the way, and not just saying directly, well, you have to anonymously, abstractly love all of humanity. You can't, just barely saying that is of no use at all. What you've got to do is find a way in which people are actually able to do something like that. And that will proceed to a large extent through individual style concretizations.
The only query I had was about the justification for guardians, because if you kind of went, okay, we've actually got the system set up on love, and one of the interesting things about love is if you love someone, you don't need to work to think about including them in the decision making. If you're going to change a job, you're probably going to think about whether or not you're still going to be able to manage the school work. And you wouldn't need to go, oh, hang on, I've got kids. It doesn't work like that. You have a different priority placing in your decision making.
Yes.
So if you've got this system, why do you then need guardians as well? So I wasn't sure what you were saying.
Well, you see, it depends what you mean by if you've got this system, and what's the system, right? So the point of the Guardian's proposal is to try to find an institution which is going to be more readily embody something like love for future people than our current institutions do, and then that institution to work as a kind of model and an example that would then tend to integrate that kind of thinking more generally into other institutions and into other prevailing social attitudes. But clearly, to some extent, there would have to be a kind of circular process here, unless you have a certain amount of kind of inclination towards something like love in the first place, then the Guardians are not going to act in a loving or caring way. Now, presumably, that would come from among other things, from the campaigning for this change. So, I'm working with a coalition of NGOs who are looking at ways of trying to entrench long-termism in British political institutions, which obviously is a big hill to climb. One of the proposals that they're considering, that we're considering, is something like the Guardian's proposal, precisely because it would be a thing to aim for, which insofar as you aim for it would hopefully encourage this sense of love, compassion, whatever. And if you achieved it, as I've hopefully succeeded briefly in illustrating there, would also go further towards achieving that. Obviously, you wouldn't need any of this if everybody was just spontaneously, completely loving, but obviously that's not the case.
Well, I think out of fairness, or maybe not towards you, but we should just restrict it to a couple of questions now.
That's where my voice goes, yeah.
Yeah, Chris, you were...
Yeah,
Chris, yeah?
Yeah, thanks so much. I really enjoyed that. It's great. And I think, boldness for me, it is a word I love. It's really powerful, it's really challenging, it's really fascinating for me.
Thank you.
And I was also really delighted to hear about your visit to the Doctor's Surgery in the magazine, because I, whenever I read the Doctor's Surgery, it's been quite very interesting magazine there in Ireland.
Oh no!
I think it's thinking about love. I mean, I think it also really depends. I totally believe in having an extended form of love that goes beyond just your children, much, much further out. And I think it quite depends on that attitude about our absolute dependence on everything that's happened for us, everything that's in this room.
That's right.
An absolute ultimate sense of gratitude.
Yes.
That everybody has contributed to us living a life today. And it's that sense of depth, not about a personal relationship, I think it extends to the whole environment, just people to all of those things.
I agree.
I think that's where it's changing. I love solidarity, I think, but I also think it's a slightly defensive thing when we're holding together to support something, and I think that makes bold steps just go one step further. And I think love is absolutely a public thing, it's not a private thing, just a private thing, it's both.
Yeah.
My one question is, you haven't mentioned at all, you mentioned liberalism, you haven't mentioned capitalism, it seems to me that that's a great movement up in the 60s, it's setting love outpouring, and then a war broke out that certain interests were not going to have this sort of love politics, it totally offends capitalism, it's the opposite of it really sharing distributing things. I just wondered if you had anything to say on that sort of economic relationship, as well as the social one, the political ideas, I don't know anything about rules, I'm not a philosopher, but...
Yeah, thanks. That's a fantastic question. So why do I talk about liberalism and not so much about capitalism? Well, I guess one reason why is because some liberals like to say or like to imagine that they are not committed to capitalism. And I think this is fakery, really. I think that the idea that I think whenever Rawls, for example, talks about liberal socialism, it's just a front, it's just a pretense. But let's take them at their word for a minute. And if we do take them at their word for a minute, then liberalism would be, if you like, a kind of broader target than capitalism. A target that it would, in other words, I want to say that if it could possibly be true that liberalism didn't depend on capitalism, liberalism still wouldn't be good enough. Liberalism would still be exposed to these kinds of problems I've indicated. But I do definitely, obviously, agree, well, not obviously, perhaps, but I do agree with your remarks about capitalism profoundly. I'm very influenced in this regard by Joel Coville's book, Capitalism, what's it called? The Enemy of Nature, The End of Capitalism or The End of the World. I think that Coville is basically right, and that capitalism, just like liberalism, continually pushes up against the limits to growth, continually turns ecology into something unecological, and continually commodifies and propertyizes in a way which is profoundly problematic. And even if it could be constrained, it would continue to strain at the leash forever and would present, therefore, a permanent danger in that regard. Now, I'm glad you like the bold word love. Let me take up your invitation by saying that I totally agree with you that love can be for a wide variety of objects. And this is, I think, one of the ways in which it is better than some of the rival candidate words we've heard this afternoon. So you can't be in solidarity with a tree, for example. You know, I just think that's absurd to say you can be in solidarity with a tree. You can love a tree. You can have a sense of oneness with a tree, right? But solidarity with a tree, no. Solidarity is something that you have with people on a picket line or, you know, lots and lots of other things. So I think solidarity is a more limited concept than love. Similarly, compassion. You can have compassion for a squirrel, but you can't have compassion for a valley. But you can love a valley. So I think that there is an advantage to the term love, not just in the boldness of its reach and of its challenge, but also in the potential breadth of what it applies to. I think we want that potential. We want that potential breadth. The love for life, love for the world, etc. That is, I think, something that we should be fostering as a society. And insofar as liberalism says that we shouldn't, and says that should be an essentially private matter, then again, so much the worse for liberalism.
Towards the end of your talk, you mentioned the idea of back to the land. I'd like to hear your views on how this would be possible without what Arnold Ness refers to in the Deep Ecology Platform, as his Deep Ecology Platform, as a substantial decrease in human population. And if you do think a substantial decrease is called for, how on earth would it be achieved?
So the easy question's last, huh? I'm not sure, really. I don't know. But I'm not convinced that it would require a substantial decrease in population from what we currently have. Look at a country like Bangladesh. Okay, I agree, it's not exactly paradise, although it would be basically an okay place to be if it didn't have a big wall around. Did you know that India are building a wall around Bangladesh? It's really, really appalling. And if it was supported better against floods, and if dangerous climate change wasn't already happening, and so on and so forth. All I'm getting at there is that there are places where there are still huge numbers of people on the land, and there are places with very high population densities. I think that back to the land applies more to the so-called developed societies, right? I'm thinking of countries like Britain, basically. And I'm not saying that everybody has to. I'm not saying everybody has to leave cities. I think cities are great, although most of the cities we have now are much too large. They're of an inhuman dimension. But I'm talking about a reduction in the size of some cities and an increase in population density on quite a lot of the land, not all, we should keep some real wilderness, etc., quite a lot of the land in a country like Britain. I mean, it is absolutely absurd that the minute percentage of our population that now works on the land, especially if there are lots of people who want to. And we're getting a sense of this through the smallholding movement and through the transition movement and so on and so forth, of the number of people who would like to spend more time on the land or indeed live on the land. And of course, there's lots of evidence from the transition movement, from permaculture and so on and so forth, that actually you can get extremely high yields in a way which doesn't deplete the soil if you have the right techniques and high labor input. So I really don't know what the answer to your question is, but I'm I'm quite suspicious of claims that have been made, including by deep ecologists, that we have to reduce our population. And I'm inclined to think that a judicious degree of returning to the land, especially in countries like ours, could be entirely compatible with something like our present level of population, and indeed could lead to being what we really need in this country is to be able to feed ourselves. That's going to be very important in years to come. At the moment, I think we quite possibly can. I think that there's every reason to believe, for example, that the farm of the future, on increasingly permacultural, etc., principles, will be able to have long-lasting, higher yields than most of our current intensive agriculture. Of course, we're also going to have changes in how we eat. You know, it's ridiculous that we eat the amount of meat that we eat on cows fed by cereals and so on and so forth. So you factor that in as well, and that does help quite a lot.
Well, it's clear we could go on with the session until dark fell, even though that's now an hour later. But I think, in fairness to, well, Rupert particularly, but the rest of us, we should stop at this point. And let's first of all thank Rupert for a very stimulating... Rupert points out that I should be saying love or compassion.
Fairness.
Obviously, the discussion...